and welcome to the NNGA podcast, Go Nuts. I'm here with my childhood friend, Amy Miller, to talk about one of the presentations she gave actually back in February at the UEFA conference that really, really stuck with me. I've known Amy my entire life, and we've been friends for almost 30 years now, through thick and thin, and her work has always been an inspiration for me. And how she looks at the world is very unique and very inspiring. So today I'd like to talk to her about some of the ideas that she brought up at a conference she recently spoke at. And we're just going to have a friendly conversation. So Amy, you want to give a brief introduction in case someone doesn't know who you are?
Yeah, sure. Hi, Gina. Thanks. Yeah, my name is Amy Miller. I am the daughter of Greg Miller, who, if any of you have been planting chestnut trees, you probably have either come across him or heard of him or bought trees from him. So I'm a third generation chestnut grower at Empire Chestnut Company / Route 9 Cooperative. My grandfather started our chestnut farm before I was born, and we're now in the process of sort of the next generational transition. I've been assuming more and more responsibilities at the farm, and excited for this next phase of my life of being, you know, a third generation chestnut grower.
Great. I had the pleasure of listening to you speak at the UEFA conference in Southern Ohio back in February. And you were giving a talk to kind of newer nut growers. But your overall idea was a little bit different than kind of the same speeches I've heard before. Can you give the audience a little bit of a summary of what you discussed?
Yeah, so the theme of my talk was really focused around land use and environmental stewardship, and sort of how nut trees in particular, and chestnut trees on our farm, the examples that I used, but how nut trees in particular can be a really good use of the land, not just economically, but also ecologically. And the title of my talk was Farm and Forest, the Chestnut Agro Ecosystem. And so I really wanted to elaborate on the point of the chestnut orchard as an ecosystem, not necessarily just a plantation crop, you know. And so I went through some of the ecosystem functions that a chestnut orchard can provide, and I compared those to, let's say, you know, annual row crops, that sort of thing, and just looked at sort of how we can produce food in a way that's also very ecologically friendly and encourages biodiversity, and can help mitigate things like climate change and loss of habitat for wildlife and that sort of thing. So I appreciate the orchard, just my orchard, not just because it's my family's livelihood and we can grow food there, but also because, you know, I can walk around in the orchard and see all kinds of interesting wildlife and understory plants and fungi, and you know, there's a whole sort of almost a forest-like world in the orchard, and it's satisfying kind of in a way, you know, in a way that you don't really get from, you know, row crops. And I guess I'm not saying that, you know, we shouldn't grow annual row crops at all. I'm just saying that, you know, looking at the chestnut orchard, it's more than just a food production system. It's also an ecosystem, and it's teeming with all kinds of life that, you know, wouldn't be there in a different type of food production system.
Interesting. Yeah, it was this comparison between these annual row crops and an orchard that really caught my attention. And I think you're correct in saying we can't, you know, we shouldn't ban all row crops, but there is a major difference between a mature orchard ecosystem and an annual row crop. Can you talk a little bit about kind of the surface details? You don't have to go in depth quite at this point, between the difference between these annual row crops and a established mature orchard.
Yeah, sure. I'm an ecologist by training, so I went to school for environmental science and ecology, and so, you know, ecology has always been something that's of great interest to me. So I look at these different areas, and in our farm in particular, so we've got young chestnut orchards, we've got mature chestnut orchards, we've got forest land surrounding our orchards, and then our neighbors have various land uses such as row crops. So it's kind of interesting for me. I get to personally experience these different types of systems and walk around in them and really observe what the differences are. And I think the point I was really trying to make in the talk was that a chestnut orchard is more like a forest than any other type of crop production system. You know, a lot of the same things you see and feel when you're walking in a forest are the things you feel in the mature chestnut orchard. You know, the trees are spaced farther apart, but, you know, we still have a lot of interesting understory plants, different types of grasses, different types of broadleaf plants, different types of mosses. We don't mow very often, and so that allows the biodiversity on the orchard floor to really flourish through most of the year. There are lots of different types of bird species that I see in the orchard on a regular basis, and different types of birds that will nest in the orchard, things like scarlet tanagers or white-breasted nuthatches, which are sort of, you know, more characterized as deep forest birds, and we see them in the orchard. You know, we have I see, you know, reptiles and amphibians that you might find, like, you know, box turtles, things that you would associate with finding in the forest, you know, we might see them in the orchard. So, you know, what I was trying to present is that, you know, as I walk through the chestnut orchard, as I walk through a forest, I see a lot of similarities and I see a lot of similar species, as opposed to when I'm walking in a more open area or a more highly disturbed area. And I guess the main thing that drives that difference is the amount of disturbance. You know, chestnuts, like I said, we mow once or twice per year. Otherwise, the understory vegetation is allowed to grow, and we don't mow until late summer. So that gives a chance for a lot of plants and animals, insects, birds, reptiles, amphibians, whatever, to actually complete their reproductive life cycle. And so we sort of allow a lot of biodiversity to continue by our management system. So, you know, as in a forest where it's a less disturbed environment, the orchard is a much less disturbed environment.
Yeah, I like that, this idea of less disturbed. And I think everyone can take a moment and think back about a moment in time where they've walked through a forest and the things that they've seen and experienced, the smells, the feel, what they saw in animal life or in plant life, and then compare it to when they've walked through a mature orchard. And a lot of those things are the same. And one thing, the difference that comes to my mind is an orchard is a little bit more orderly, right? You have all the trees and rows, but you have a lot of similarities. So you talked a little bit about kind of these ecological cycles. So can you give us kind of a brief description of like a year-long ecological cycle from, you know, spring to winter on what you see in a mature orchard and how that kind of relates to stewardship of the land?
Yeah, that was one thing that I like to show pictures of the orchard at different times of the year. And, you know, so in the springtime where we are now, it's definitely that time of new life. You know, it's exciting to watch the leaves slowly come out on the different plants. Actually, the last 2 weeks, I've noticed in particular, you know, the moss is bright green. We actually have a lot of moss on our orchard floor. And later in the summer, you won't be able to see it very much. It'll be mostly grass. But at the moment, the moss is like a vibrant, bright green carpet underneath these brown dormant trees. And it's quite a beautiful sight. It's one of my favorite times of the year. And the window for that is very short. And it's only like maybe a week or so when the moss is like fully productive and the grass really hasn't started growing yet. So that's what's happening now. And then, you know, as the season goes on, the grasses and other broadleaf plants will start to grow. The chestnut trees themselves, they leaf out late compared to other trees. So other forest trees like the, you know, maples and cherries, they're going to start leafing out and blooming earlier. Oaks come out later and chestnuts are kind of on par with that. So the chestnuts will really start leafing out. Well, it depends on the season, you know, really, but on the weather conditions. But, you know, here in eastern Ohio, they'll start leafing out probably late April, early May. And then, you know, the sequence of how things bloom in the forest. So in the surrounding forest, different types of trees will start blooming in sequence. And one of the last trees to bloom are the chestnuts. And the chestnuts and the catalpas bloom at the same time. And that kind of marks the end of the tree flowering season. And our chestnuts here, they typically don't bloom until mid-June. And one of the fascinating things about chestnut bloom, so any of you who grow Chinese chestnuts, you know that they produce these catkins, long fuzzy flat male flowers that are loaded with pollen. And Chinese chestnuts overproduce pollen compared to other types of chestnut trees or other trees in general. You know, a lot of growers kind of scratch their heads like, why do these trees produce so many male flowers? And it really is a pollen cloud. You know, it doesn't smell that great, but one thing I've noticed as I look at the flowers, there are so many different types of insects that feed on those flowers. Those fuzzy catkins are covered with bugs, you know, including some of the beneficials like bees, but then also, you know, things like Japanese beetles and rose chafers and even chestnut weevils. It's part of the chestnut weevil life cycle. They actually feed on the pollen in June before they, you know, before they don't lay their eggs till August, but they feed on the pollen in May, or June rather. So anyway, the flowering trees are full of life. And I think that's sort of an underappreciated aspect of the ecosystem services that chestnuts provide. And then the other thing that I think is fascinating is that so chestnut pollen is wind dispersed. So we don't need pollinator bees to take the pollen from one flower to another. It just travels on the wind. Pollen grains are really small, and that's how they pollinize the female flowers. But so if you can imagine this giant cloud of pollen that's just traveling in the air and traveling all over the landscape, and pollen is very rich in phosphorus. So this is a way, sort of a very natural way, that phosphorus travels and cycles through the environment. And if pollen lands in all these areas that aren't female flowers, which let's face it, most of the pollen is going to end up somewhere that's not a female flower, that provides a phosphorus source for other plants. And it's a readily available source of phosphorus that other plants can uptake pretty easily. So actually, the chestnut orchard plays an important role in nutrient cycling on the landscape in general. Let's see. All right, so going to seasons. So that takes us through the summer. And then as the summer unfolds, that's when we really see the breeding birds in the orchard. So, you know, June through July, we'll see some of those birds, like I mentioned, like the scarlet tanagers or the nuthatches. Nuthatches are cavity nesters, but most of our trees are old enough and have various, you know, hollowed out areas from pruning and other, you know, physiological reasons. So we see nuthatches actually coming and going in little holes in the trees, which is pretty cute. And of course, all these different types of birds are feeding on all those insects that are eating the pollen. And so the birds will nest kind of through July or so. And then once August rolls around, then we're really starting to think about harvest. You know, we've kind of let the trees do their thing. We've let the animals do their thing. And now, you know, come fall, it's time for us to harvest our product. And so by mid to late August, we'll start mowing the orchard and spraying for chestnut weevils. Chestnut weevils are a big pest. And on a large scale that we operate, we have not found efficient ways to control them organically, or even successful ways. Even if they're not efficient, we haven't found successful ways to control them organically. So we do spray for chestnut weevils once or twice per year. And that's, like I said, those weevils, they're feeding on the flowers in June. And then they go away somewhere. I don't know where they go. Nobody knows where they go. but then they come back to the orchard in late August, and they lay their eggs in the chestnuts. They actually are able to oviposit all the way through the burr into the nut inside the developing burr and lay their eggs in there. And so that's when we spray for them, is when they're coming back to lay their eggs. And like I said, that's when we mow to start preparing for harvest. And then by mid-September, harvest begins and is in full swing by the end of September. And, that's the time of year, sort of late summer, late fall, when, you know, a lot of the was from the animal perspective, a lot of animals have reproduced. They're sort of raising their young. They're kind of teaching them things. They're working on, you know, maybe birds especially might be thinking about migration or, you know, heading off to their whatever their winter habitat is. And we certainly see some wildlife in the orchard still, but things are much quieter than in the summer. And so, you know, we enjoy our harvest season. The weather's, well, depends on the year, but often it's very nice in September and October. We have sunny days that aren't too hot. And we have a lot of people that come out and harvest. We do all hand harvesting. And so, you know, it's kind of a very joyous, bountiful time of year. And then, you know, by the end of November, the trees are starting to go to bed for the winter. And the past few years, when we've had pretty nice weather into October, November, the trees keep growing. Some trees in the forest, you know, they sort of have a determinate amount of growth, right? They'll grow a certain amount, and then they'll stop and lose their leaves, and that's all they do every given year. The chestnuts seem very opportunistic. As long as the weather conditions are favorable, their leaves will stay green and they'll keep growing. And for the last couple of years, we've had green leaves on the chestnuts well into November. You know, the surrounding forest trees have sort of gone to bed for the winter and chestnuts are still growing. And actually, I think that extended late season vigor helps with the tree's overall health. So I'm happy to see that happening. But, you know, by the end of November, December, the trees have gone to bed and then, you know, leaves have fallen and we leave all leaf litter there to compost, to be natural compost and fertilizer for next year. And you know, cycle continues again.
Well, it's really interesting to really stop and think about this cycle because sometimes it's just really easy to get caught up on things. But to really take a look at these different changes throughout the year is fantastic and how it impacts our, you know, not only the forest, but the livelihood. You've given a really great explanation of what's happening and what's going on, but now I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of a chestnut grower or, you know, another nut grower. And I want to ask the question, why? Why should I care about considering the stewardship of the land or taking care of the land? And I feel like some of that answer is obvious, like, well, duh, you live here. But I would really like to hear from an ecological standpoint on not only why should new growers consider this when they're planting an orchard, why should established growers consider this when they're maintaining their orchard, but maybe steps in which they can make this cycle a little bit easier, which sounds pretty easy to me since a lot of it's hands-off.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is a good question, the question of why. And you know, I think the important thing to remember and the thing that we as a society seem to forget pretty easily is how connected everything is, right? I mean, we're so connected to the land, even though we may seem really distant, right? A lot of us might spend a lot of time indoors. We might not be actually growing gardens or living off the land or farming, but yet we're connected to the earth in so many ways. You know, everything affects us, air quality, water quality, food quality, all affect how we live, even if we're not farmers in particular. And, you know, I don't say that as like a crazy hippie. I say that from a very practical point of view, you know. The more people realize that the connection between the health of the land and our own health as individuals and as a society, you know, the better off we're going to be. And so, you know, that's why I view growing chestnuts not just from an economic perspective, like, yeah, we produce this crop and sell it and make money to live, but also this is a way to create a landscape and create an environment where we ourselves can be healthy people, you know, and raise healthy families and, you know, be healthy neighbors. So, you know, things like, you know, hot item, news items are like water quality, for example. You know, Those of us in Ohio for the last several years, we've been hearing a lot about water quality in Lake Erie in particular, and, you know, harmful algal blooms and runoff and, you know, these things that, you know, some more years ago sounded just like you know, environmentalist hand wringing, but now are affecting people directly. You know, mm-hmm. when Toledo's water system shuts down, that's a very real consequence, right? So, I think it's important to look at the landscape from what we can do to actually create an environment in which we can take care of our air and take care of our water. And certainly, I think, you know, those of us who grow trees, we're all on board with that. You know, we recognize the trees are an incredibly valuable tool for water quality and air quality, and also food quality too. You know, this highly processed foods that are, you know, corn and soy based lead to a lot of health problems within our society. And again, I'm not saying we shouldn't eat any of those things, but you know, we really need to think about what it is we're putting in our bodies and where did it come from and how much processing did it have. And, you know, things like nut crops, whether it be chestnuts or walnuts or hazels or whatever, those are very sort of healthy, natural, wholesome ways to get a lot of good calories, you know. So from an individual health perspective, too, these things can be very helpful. And again, I don't think that's a radical way of thinking. I think that's a very practical way of thinking. And mm-hmm. And so I would encourage other nut growers to think about that too, not just think about, can I, you know, what kind of money can I make from growing this crop, but how am I taking care of my land to ensure the best health for me, my family, my neighbors, my community?
Exactly. I think that's a very powerful point there.